Iran says the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency has failed to remain impartial and is making anti-Iran comments beyond his technical capacity. The UN refugee chief slams the UK's plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda as, quote, all wrong, saying it sets a catastrophic precedent. Also ahead, the European Union threatens legal action against the UK over London's decision to unilaterally revise Northern Ireland's post-Brexit trade arrangements. Thank you for joining us. Now, top story this hour, Iran has defended its measures in response to the recent resolution against the country's nuclear program by the Board of Governors at the International Atomic Energy Agency.
Definitely, we couldn't let the political and non-technical measure of the agency go unanswered. Our actions have been decisive and proportionate. What Iran is doing now falls strictly under its nuclear safeguards obligations. What Iran has stopped doing is its voluntary measures. It is unfortunate if the IAEA's Director General would not know this or intentionally pose Iran's measures differently. Iran is entitled to end the commitments it undertook as a goodwill gesture when the other party violates a formerly agreed obligation. Therefore, Iran's measures create no proliferation worries.
The spokesman also said the IAEA's resolution is driven by Israel and backed by its Western allies. Khatibzadeh also slammed the IAEA chief for his recent meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister in Tel Aviv, saying it was a meeting in the wrong place at the wrong time and with a wrong person. He said the agency's director general has failed his duty to remain impartial and has been making comments against Iran beyond his technical capacity. The spokesman also dismissed the Director General's comments that Iran's measures impede an agreement in the Vienna talks. He said the obstacle to the talks remains the U.S.'s refusal to fulfill its obligations under the 2015 agreement. Now, the UN refugee chief has denounced the UK government's plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda just a day before the first plane was due to depart. Filippo Grandi described London's plan as, quote, all wrong. The UN agency has expressed concerns about a lack of legal redress in Rwanda and potential discrimination against asylum seekers. The UN refugee chief warned the plan sets a precedent that is catastrophic. On Monday, a UK Court of Appeal upheld the decision to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. That was after a High Court refused to grant a temporary injunction suspending the first flight. The UK government has shrugged off criticisms of the plan. It says the one-way flights to Rwanda are aimed at deterring others from entering Britain through the English Channel by illegal routes. Over 10,000 people have crossed the channel in small boats so far this year. The Northern Ireland Protocol still remains a sticking point between the UK and the EU. Now the bloc threatens legal action after London introduced legislation to unilaterally revise the Northern Ireland's post-Brexit trade arrangements. European Commission Vice President Maroš Šefčovič said Brussels would consider reopening a suspended infringement procedure against Britain. He said the procedure aims to protect the EU single market from risks posed by a violation of the protocol. Šefčovič warned the UK's unilateral action negatively affects the mutual trust between London and Brussels. He stressed the Europeans would renegotiate neither the divorce deal nor the Northern Ireland's trade protocol. On Monday, the UK government presented legislation to Parliament to overhaul the Northern Ireland Protocol. London believes the implementation of the protocol has damaged trade within the UK. It says the protocol has led to unnecessary bureaucracy for businesses moving goods between Britain and Northern Ireland. Nearly two decades after the UK's participation in the US-led invasion of Iraq, the man who took Britain to war has received one of the country's highest honours from the Queen. But to those who opposed the illegal invasion from day one, Tony Blair has blood on his hands and should stand trial at The Hague. Saeed Poreza has this report from a protest against the former Prime Minister's knighthood in London.
Reading out the names of fallen British soldiers in Iraq while a man responsible for their deaths and millions more is honored. Only meters away, a protest organized by Stop the War Coalition calling for former Prime Minister Tony Blair's knighthood ceremony to stop.
It's an absolute outrage that someone who lied to the people, lied to Parliament, lied to the Cabinet, took us into an illegal war which led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people and destroyed a country should be given a knighthood. I mean, it's a disgrace.
The biggest of those lies in the so-called Iraq War dossier, a claim that former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed mass murder weapons.
We knew in September 2002 that the dossier amounted to nothing. We were told it proved there were weapons of mass destruction. Everybody serious who looked at that said it didn't prove anything of the sort. Blair was determined to go to war regardless. He was determined whatever the evidence said. So essentially they cooked up the evidence.
In 2016, all the lies were exposed by the so-called Chilcot report that concluded Iraq posed no immediate threat at the time of the 2003 invasion. For Tony Blair, though, who defended his decision to go to war, that has not meant a war crimes tribunal, but the UK's most prestigious knighthood. To anti-war activists, that is a dangerous precedent.
Well, it's trying to make it easier to go to war in future. It's trying to say to politicians, even if you go to war and it's illegal, it's criminal, it's based on lies, it has nothing but devastating impact, you can still be honoured, it'll be forgive and forget.
But forgive and forget they have not. Tony Blair continues to be one of the most detested politicians at home and abroad.
Nearly two decades since the Iraq War, Tony Blair is known by tens of millions here and abroad as a war criminal, despite efforts to reinvent himself as a visionary leader, which is why these protesters say the only court Tony Blair should be attending today is not a royal one. Saeed Poreza is up, London.
Elsewhere, pro-Russian forces in the Donetsk region have requested reinforcements from Moscow following reports of heavy shelling of residential areas. A local official in Donetsk says the Ukrainian forces have, quote, crossed all lines and used prohibited methods of warfare. The local sources also say a maternity hospital has been damaged due to massive artillery shelling of Donetsk by Ukrainian forces. Regional health officials say the hospital's patients and staff were already evacuated and were not injured in the attack. The Donetsk area has been subjected to heavy rocket and artillery attacks by the Ukrainian military over the past few days. The shelling became particularly strong on Monday, with dozens of incidents registered by local authorities. The NATO Secretary-General says Sweden has taken important steps to meet Turkey's demands for approving Stockholm's application to become a member of the military alliance.
I welcome that Sweden has already started to change its counter-terrorism legislation and that Sweden will ensure that the legal framework for arms export will reflect their future status as a NATO member with new commitments to allies. These are two important steps to address concerns Turkey has raised.
One question each for you.
Jens Stoltenberg says he hopes that Sweden and Finland would join NATO as soon as possible. The two Nordic countries applied to join the alliance last month in response to Russia's military operation in Ukraine, but their applications faced opposition from Turkey, which cites their support for Kurdish militants and a previous decision by the two to withdraw arms export licenses to Turkey. Elsewhere, China has lashed out at the United States after Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin accused Beijing of adopting a more coercive and aggressive approach in the region, including near Taiwan.
I would like to stress that by repeatedly spreading disinformation and painting an ugly picture of China, the US could only further expose its ill intention to sow discord and the true nature of its hegemonic practices, an exercise of power politics.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman blamed the US for fueling tensions by militarizing the Asia-Pacific region. He cited America's increasing deployment of military jets and warships in the South China Sea. He also accused Washington of supporting those who are seeking the independence of Taiwan, saying such measures are the biggest threat to peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait. Beijing is opposed to Washington's growing military and diplomatic ties with Taiwan, a self-ruled island that China considers as part of its territory. Recently, President Joe Biden also angered China after he vowed to defend Taiwan militarily if attacked.
China and the US are locked in a growing war of words over the self-ruled island of Taiwan, which Beijing considers as part of its territory. But now, amid simmering tensions between the superpowers, at the security summit in Singapore, Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin accused the Chinese military of provocative and destabilizing activities near Taiwan. During the same event, the Chinese defense minister hit back at the US, saying Beijing had no choice but to fight if attempts are made to separate Taiwan from China.
If anyone dares to secede Taiwan from China, we will not hesitate to fight. We will fight at all costs, and we definitely will fight to the very end. This is the only choice for China.
I think it was very clear the exchange that General Wei had with Secretary Austin was quite straightforward as far as we understand. And his speech was also, of course, very sharp. In terms of outlining what the Chinese were prepared to do if Taiwan would declare for independence. Now, both these people laid out their positions on this, but the question is still very unclear how far the United States is willing to go in trying to use Taiwan in their attempt to bring together the countries of Asia as a counter to China.
But China also struck a more pacifying tone, calling for a stable China-US relationship. Wei stated that the China-US relation is at a critical and crucial juncture. He added that Beijing believes a stable Sino-US relation serves the interests of both countries and the rest of the world. The Chinese defense minister also noted that China had achieved impressive progress in the field of nuclear weapons. Wei, however, noted that Beijing will only use them for defending the nation, never starting a nuclear war, nor ever use nuclear weapons first. He pointed out that the ultimate purpose of China's nuclear arsenal is to prevent a nuclear war.
Well, the latest round of altercation between the two countries comes as they held their first face-to-face talks on the sidelines of a summit in Singapore on Friday. During the event, however, China also stated that besides military provocations, Washington is trying to, quote, hijack countries in the Indo-Pacific region. The remark came in reference to the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which the U.S. announced in May and involves 13 countries, excluding China.
The Chinese defense minister slammed Washington's new strategy, stating that it will lead to further tension between the two countries.
The reality we are witnessing is different to U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin's remarks on the Indo-Pacific strategy. The strategy is an attempt to build an exclusive small group in the name of a free and open Indo-Pacific to hijack countries in the region and target one specific country. It's a strategy to create confrontation to contain and encircle others.
Meanwhile, regional countries also seem to be unaligned with Washington's stance, especially in the light of China's direct investment in Pacific Island countries, which it views as important components of its Belt and Road Initiative.
The Chinese have had a very ambitious and very successful program with the Belt and Road Initiative, which has helped to fill the deficit in infrastructure in the Asia Pacific, and this is only beginning now. What the U.S. has to offer is a system of rules in which these countries must abide by, possibly in order to attain increased trade, but they're really not offering anything concrete other than being associated with the United States and a few other countries.
Washington has made no secret about its stance on China, but the new world order and financial order is taking shape already, and the U.S. is left behind. The U.S.'s use of the dollar as a weapon has pushed nations who have been targeted closer together. This includes energy-rich powerhouses like Iran, Russia, and Venezuela. Even Saudi Arabia is changing some of its oil sales to the yuan. Therefore, it now seems that the U.S. is on the losing side of the ongoing rivalry with China, especially considering what many believe to be its failure both militarily and economically.
That brings an end to World Bulletin for this hour.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight. Climatenomics by former White House reporter and director of environmental entrepreneurs Bob Keefe is a narrative account of how the climate crisis is fundamentally altering not just the US but global economics. We are prepared for you an article written by Edward Helmore. The piece is titled New Book Says Climate Crisis is Battering U.S. Economy and Driving Inflation. According to a new book, Forget Ukraine, Coronavirus, Corporate Greed and Supply Chain Issues – When it comes to inflation, the climate crisis is the real lasting worry, and one that's only likely to get worse. Climatenomics, by former White House reporter and director of environmental entrepreneurs Bob Keefe, is a narrative account of how the climate crisis is fundamentally altering not just the US, but global economics. Within its pages, Bob Keefe lays out what he sees as the false choice between creating jobs and driving economic growth and protecting the planet, and how supply chain disruptions has become a euphemism for the effects of climate change. Keefe says, "I don't think people have realized that climate change is an economic issue now, because it's always been seen as an environmental, health or social issue." He added, "The fact of the matter is climate change is battering our economy." Political and monetary policy leaders hinted as much recently after the US Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen acknowledged that inflation had reached unacceptable highs. It hit a 40-year high of 8.6% in the year to the end of May. 2 days later, the White House said, "Our hemisphere is facing the devastating impacts and costs of climate change," ahead of Joe Biden's Summit of the Americas in the city of Los Angeles. Assessing the role of climate change on economies is one thing, but for now, most models merely assess the cost of climate-related disasters, not their underlying effect on inflation. According to Bob Keefe, citing National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration figures, climate-related weather disasters cost the U.S. economy more than $145 billion in 2021, a nearly 50% increase from last year. Over the last 5 years, they have cost $750 billion. Since 1980, 323 weather and climate disasters have cost $1 billion or more, the total cost of these events exceeding $2.195 trillion. Moreover, according to a report from the reinsurance firm Swiss Re last year, climate disasters could cost the American economy 10% of gross domestic product, or GDP, the broadest measure of economic health, by 2050. Globally, that figure rises to 18%. A 2018 National Climate Assessment projects that rising temperatures and extreme heat are projected to decrease worker productivity by $221 billion a year by 2090, and climate-related weather disasters are projected to cost the U.S. $500 billion a year. Another study published in Environmental Research Letters in July of last year found long-term warning contributed $27 billion to the losses covered by the U.S. crop insurance program from 1991 to 2017, or just over 19% of the total. In 2012, the single costliest year, rising temperatures contributed nearly half of losses valued at $18.6 billion. While each of those relate to gross domestic product and productivity, none specifically refer to inflation and inflationary pressure, prices rising over time, and are not factored into official government statistics related by the Bureau of Labor's Consumer Price Index, the CPI, which measures the changing prices of a basket of goods and services. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and the Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell have faced criticism for initially describing inflation as a transitory problem that would resolve itself. Janet Yellen has admitted that her initial evaluation of the economy was wrong and that she and Jerome Powell could have used a better term than transitory. She said that the bulk of inflation was related to imbalances in supply and demand. But that, too, has climate component, says David Supper, a professor of law and economics at Georgetown University, who argues that climate change is largely ignored as an inflationary driver, in part because it is manifesting as a global problem in overt and covert ways that makes the direct inflationary impact hard to assess. David Supper says, "Its impact is broad and systemic, so there is no one item in the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, that you can say reflects climate change. We can say that grain and gas oil costs reflect the Ukraine war, but you can't do that with climate change because it affects so many things. Loss of timber and homes due to wildfires in the western United States might show up in housing construction costs, or the cost of retrofitting homes to guard against coastal erosion and flooding." David Supper points out, right there you have several things that are either increasing demand or undermining supply. And that's just one small part of it. Similarly, supply chain issues frequently cited as inflationary may not simply be issues around China, COVID lockdowns affecting manufacturing, but a range of issues from roads washing out or loss of crops due to extreme weather events and shifting weather patterns. The Consumer Price Index, the CPI, is focused on results and not causes. The responsibility to assess causes rests with the White House Council of Economic Advisers, or National Economic Council, bodies that have attempted to come out with estimates that have been met with challenges to their data by climate deniers, resulting in paralysis. David Supper says, that has led to less eagerness to do estimations in areas where a lot of estimates would have to be made because there's so little inclination to assume those estimates would be done in good faith. He added, in the face of a well-funded climate denier industry, the estimates get turned into a sideshow. Shifting the climate crisis from an environmental to an economic issue is at the heart of what climatonomics presents. Bob Keefe says, what's required is an effort similar in scale to the shift from the industrial to the information age to renewable energy, and with it, provisions to counter climate change's increasing disruption. Bob Keefe says, what we do know is that the economic cost of climate change, both from weather disasters and commodities costs, is taking an increasing toll on economies. But if one of the major inflationary forces is climate, it's also one that can't be tackled simply by central bankers adjusting interest rates. According to David Supper, seeing climate change as an environmental issue, which it is, but not as an economic issue, which it surely is as well, is now in the process of changing. David Supper says the current round of inflation has widened people's eyes to it. Sure, the pandemic and the war in Ukraine are part of it, but I think this is a teachable moment that will allow people to see just how pervasive climate change is in affecting the way we live. We have framed the climate concern in extremely narrow ways, never a good idea with a complex social phenomena or with something as all-encompassing as this.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the thoughts and speeches of the leader of the Muslim Ummah, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Naghwi and Sheikh Rouhani. Sayyid Naghwi, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. And Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about the status and the role of Imam Ali ibn Musa Rizali alayhi salam. who's buried in the holy city of Mashhad. May Allah give us the chance of paying a visit to the city of Mashhad these days. Imam Reza alayhi salam had so much influence even on the court of, we can say, Ma'mun. We can say that so many people around Ma'mun and the Ma'mun, we can say, the power and the throne were influenced by the very character of Imam Reza alayhi salam on that time. So, do you believe that Ma'mun was successful in controlling Imam Reza alayhi salam?
For sure, I say, like, up to some extent, he was successful. But on the other hand, because Imam was a person who was famous amongst the Muslim community, not only Muslim, but the others. And there were many things, we can say, like, many blunders, which were done by Ma'mun himself. And one of the things was, as you mentioned, the dialogue between the Imam and the other scholars of the other religions or the school of thoughts, which Imam obviously answered the Jews according to their book, the Christians according to their book, the Bible. And there were other people from other religions as well. So this dialogue was basically organized by Ma'mun himself in order to show him downward, whereas when we talk about the infallible Imam, their knowledge is from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's right.
They have ilmul ladunni, which we call like it's been given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This family, the Ahlul Bayt, they're different from the ordinary people.
That's right.
So this was the mentality.
And was the wrong, I think, understanding from the side of Ma'mun about Imam Reza alayhi salam.
For sure, okay. Because they never
It shows his intelligence and brilliance.
He was, but obviously because they do not have the ma'rifah, they don't know, because they are basically sink in their personal desires.
Okay.
So if they knew about the reality of Imam, they would never oppose Imam. The main issue is that.
Okay.
You know, even the Quraysh, they used to say like Prophet is just like us.
Yes.
Even today we have some people like, for example, the Wahhabism or the Al Saudi, they claim that the Prophet is an ordinary man, there is no use of going to the grave of the Prophet, praying. So we have these ideologies in today's world, and even the same ideology was at that time.
That's right.
So basically, because he never realized the real personality and the status of Imam, that's why these things happen. But on the other hand, obviously, Imam became famous, popular because of his actions, these kind of actions. On the other hand, you know, there was the famous story about the rain.
Yes, the rain prayer. Yes, the drought was unnerved.
So these things made Imam much more popular.
Yes.
And obviously the popularity of Imam, Imam being the truth, haq, it was clearly, shown, and it became apparent for the people. Mm. So when we look at this aspect, then we can say, like, even when Ma'mun brought Imam, it didn't, we can say, like, affected the responsibility and the activities of Imam the way it should be, like, when we look apparently about.
And did Ma'mun really feel danger from the side of Imam that he decided to martyr him, Shaykh?
It is really interesting to know that in Khurasan, in Marv, in those areas, at the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, a person called Shansab ibn Khurrang. So he came to Kufa from that place in Khurasan, and he stayed in Kufa for a few weeks with the Imams, with Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. When he came back to Khurasan, he established Ali Shansab. So it was a kind of Shiite government or the first Shiite government in Khurasan.
Yes.
So from that time on, the Shia was spreaded a lot in this area.
Yes.
So that's why when Imam Al-Ali came to Khurasan, so these numberless people, when they followed and gathered Imam Al-Ali, of course, then Ma'mun was fearful not from the Imam himself, but from the followers of the Imam Al-Ali, from the people of the Khurasan.
Yes.
So, and also it is said by some of the historians that it was because of the fear of Ma'mun from the people of Khurasan that he invited Imam Al-Ali
to
make them silent, to keep them silent. to tell them that, yeah, of course, I do accept the Alawiyyuns and I do not have any problem with Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam. You know that the Amawid regime was, yes, was toppled down by the people of Khorasan.
Yes.
So they came from Khorasan by, what is that, the name of Abu Muslim Khorasani.
Abu Muslim Khorasani, yeah. Yes.
So these people helped, yes, the Abbasids to get the power. So, of course, Ma'mun was really fearful from these people. That, of course, if I do not give the true power to Imam Rida alayhi salatu wasalam, then the people are there. And these are the people of Khorasan who put an end to the governing of to the Amawids.
Yes.
So they can do the same with us.
Yes.
So that's why, of course,
and beside Imam Ali alayhi salam, I think Imam Reza alayhi salam was the only Shia infallible Imam who had role or at least considered as a part of the government, isn't it?
So after Imam is the second person. Imam Hassan.
Okay.
Imam Hassan had the rulership, but later he had to, you know.
It was abrogated.
It was abrogated.
That's right.
And after then it's Imam Rida alayhi salam, yes.
The most serious time is that part. They say that there was a break for the Shia world at the time of Imam al-Baghir alayhi salam and Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam in that period, you know. Something between, I think, is it between Umayyads,
of course,
and the Abbasids at the time of Marwanids, isn't it?
Of course, yeah. And also among Abbasids themselves, there were problems, challenges.
Okay,
they had challenges. Problems with themselves. Yeah, so they were busy with themselves, it gave a chance to the Imams to spread their teachings, to teach the people, to gather the people in Medina. That's the kind of chance that was given.
The
Imams, yeah.
And the people of Persia. Nowadays Iran, were famous for following the Shiism and the Tashayyu, and they were the followers of the Ahlul Bayt. So with coming of an Imam at that time, which is, of course, a part of the, we can say, Abbasid Caliphate. It is not like geographical borders that we have today, you know. Iraq and Iran at that time part of the same land of the Abbasid Caliphate. From one side, we have the golden age of the Abbasids, you know, this high boost of the sciences and, you know, encouragement of the scientists in order to go and discover new fields of studies. And from the other side, we have the presence of Imam Reza alayhi salam. And usually the people do not make comparisons between these two. How to value them? Sayyid, what's your take on that?
Well, obviously, when we look at the golden age that you're talking about, that was a time when, you know, scholars were honored.
Okay.
Obviously, they were much more free in communicating with the people frequently and on the other side as well. But when we look at the personality of Imam Rida alayhi salatu wasalam, obviously Imam Rida was on above of all. Because, you know, we had the dialogues, we had the way, like before Imam Rida, like Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, how he answered everyone.
Yes.
So I think why we call it a golden age is because that was a much more peaceful, we can say, time for the Muslim Ummah after the Prophet, where, you know, the Muslim Ummah was in the battles all the time. We can see at the time of the first three caliphates, for example, there was an invasion of the Persia,
that's right,
Persian territory. After that, when Imam Ali alayhi salam got that khilafah, the apparent khilafah, obviously he was involved in three wars, and then the Banu Umayyah and Banu Abbas.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was the Ma'mun al-Rashid's time, when, you know, after killing the Amin.
Yes.
So he got relaxed.
The half-brother.
And, you know, the whole Ummah was in a state that there was no more mm-hmm. war amongst the Muslim Ummah. So that's why the scholars became, you know, apparent, like their role
okay.
was, we can say, like it became in front of people. And people from the thoughts and the worries which they had for yes. the wars and the battles and the
yes.
problems that they had okay. between two governments, it was a kind of resolved. And that's why we see this golden age.
That's right.
And the peak of knowledge at that time.
And they have always referred to their relative familial relations, because the Abbasids believed to be among the close cousins of the Ahlul Bayt mm-hmm. and the Hashemites, you know, and that made a reason in order to invite them. But at the same time, I say, as you said, the table was flipped, I think, mm-hmm. by Imam Reza alayhi salam on that time, and the story was changed. That's why Ma'mun decided to martyr Imam Reza alayhi salam.
There is an important aspect which we generally do not discuss okay. when we talk about the infallible imams, and that is that every single imam made grounds for the last imam.
Mm-hmm.
And we never talk about it.
Okay.
We generally talk about it when we yes, talk yes. about Imam Hassan Askari and Imam okay. Kazim, for yes, example. Yes, yes. But when we look at the history, for example, the narrations that we have from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam about Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, because mm-hmm. we are living in this time now.
Yes.
When we talk about an infallible imam or the role of imam, we need to discuss about our time as well.
Okay.
And what is our duty?
Yes.
And this is very important, that when we look at the narrations given by Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, he talks about the Imam Mahdi, and he says, like, if I can come at that time when Imam Mahdi is there, I will be serving him mm-hmm. in the best way. After that, we can see, like, how he made educates, how he trained students. Later, at the time of even Imam Raza, when he was in the surveillance of Ma'mun Rashid,
yes.
even at that time, Imam had representatives
yes.
in different parts of the, we can say, like Muslim territory.
Okay.
And they used to communicate, they used to come and go, collecting the homes or answering the people, their questions. So this thing was made. Why? Because there will be a time when the last imam will come. He will go to the occultation. And there is right. a need of this kind of, we can say, culture.
Okay.
And this culture was also made. And we can apparently see that in the life of Imam Radha. Why we say like Ma'mun Rashid couldn't have or he wasn't successful in controlling imam. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons is that because, you know, imam had other operations, the hidden operations, yes. which he was okay. doing through his representatives.
And we know that we had so many denominations inside Shiism, like Zaydis and Waqifis. But yeah, when it gets yeah. to Imam al-Raza alayhi salam, all of a sudden, the 12th Shia Imam comes to yeah, our mind, you know.
Yeah.
In fact, the missing link between the previous Imams and the following Imams is the very presence of Imam al-Raza alayhi salam. That's why he says that, if somebody believes in me, he is believing the 12 imams as the Sa'a Shari. So really, we can say, complementary role in the Shiite ideology, in the Ithna Ashari, we can say, methodology.
One of the reasons is because other imams had two or three sons, or many sons.
Yes.
But Imam Radha had only one son. Mm-hmm. So you never see a person being eight imam, like believing in eight imam. We have people, Ismaili, who believe in six
yes.
imam.
Yes.
We have people like Zaydi who believe Zaydi's in four imam.
Yes.
So you will never see like someone who believe in eight imam and that's it.
Okay.
Because he has to move on to Imam Taqi alayhi salam. And after that, to Imam Naqi. Why? Because brother of Imam Naqi, Musa Mubarakah, who's buried in Qom, he obviously, he passed away in the life of Imam. And after that, in the life of Imam Naqi, obviously we see the other things. So this chain continues. And that's why Imam Taqi is also known as Jawadul A'imma.
Yes, that's right.
You know, obviously this series, it never stops. So we have either sixth, those who believe in six or four. And if someone comes on the door of Imam Radha, then he has to believe in 12 Imams.
That's right, inshallah. May Allah give us the chance to go to the door and to the inshallah. Gates of the very holy shrine of Imam al-Raza alayhi salam, pray over there. And this is really a wish for so many Muslims and the Shias all across the world to have a travel to the city of Mashhad in Iran, in Khorasan. You know, Shah of Khorasan, they say, the king or is the ruler of Khorasan. May Allah give us the chance of go there and pay homage to the very holy presence and holy shrine of Imam Reza alayhi salam over there. Thank you, my Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Sheikh Rouhani, for your presence in the program Viewpoints, talking about the role and the status of Imam Reza alayhi salam in spreading Tashayyu in Iran or Persia. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. Also, you can visit our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
is not the same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. You are the light that guides me through my darkest night, shows me right from wrong in life. That often lies, cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Germany is allowing the Israeli regime to get away with the killing of 6 of its citizens in an air attack on a high-rise building in Gaza 8 years ago. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Ali Abu Nima, journalist. This article is published under the heading Germany permits Israeli regime to kill its citizens with impunity. Here's more. Germany is allowing the Zionist regime to get away with the killing of 6 of its citizens in an air attack on a high-rise building in Gaza 8 years ago. The country's federal prosecutor decided not to open a formal investigation into the 21st of July 2014 airstrike on the Asalan Tower in Gaza City that killed Ibrahim Kilani, his wife Tagrid, and their 5 children aged 3 to 11. Ibrahim and the children Elias, Yasser, Yasin, Sausan, and Rim were all German citizens. They were among more than 2,200 Palestinians, including 550 children, killed during the Zionist regime's 51-day bombardment of Gaza that summer. The decision of the German federal prosecutor not to investigate the death of our family members, despite the evidence of war crimes, is politically motivated. Ramses Kilani, Ibrahim's adult son who lives in Germany, told the electronic Intifada, adding, "Propagandists often talk about double standards, referring to the treatment of Israel. And there are double standards in favor of Israel," Kilani added. Germany is legally obliged to investigate potential war crimes against its citizens, he added. The German federal prosecutor's decision stands as emblematic of the double standards applied in cases against powerful actors. According to the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, ECCHR, and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, PCHR, the prosecutor's decision was taken in August, but the group said they did not comment on it until now, as they had only gained access to relevant files in April. Soon after the attack, ECCHR and PCHR filed a criminal complaint along with Ramses Kilani. They submitted evidence and analysis to the prosecutor on numerous occasions, but to no avail. The approach taken by the prosecutor did not follow standard procedures and lines of argumentation, especially with regard to the German citizenship of some of the victims, the human rights groups state. German law requires the prosecutor to open an investigation because the victims included German citizens, but the prosecutor improperly invokes exceptions to evade their requirements, according to ECCHR and PCHR. Among the excuses was that there was already an investigation by the Zionist regime's military advocate general, and that all domestic remedies, meaning processes in occupied Palestinian territories, had not been exhausted. But the Zionist regime's self-investigations are notoriously a sham. 2 years after the 2014 assault on Gaza, B'Tselem, an Israeli human rights group, called the Zionist regime's investigation of crimes committed by its forces they're a whitewash. Following every major massacre of civilians in Gaza, including this one in 2014, the fabricated regime of Israel deflected criticism by promising to investigate its conduct, B'Tselem observed, but the group noted last year that nothing came of this promise. True policy change will come about only when Israel is forced to pay a price for its conduct, actions and policies, B'Tselem said, and that will only come when the smokescreen of domestic investigations is lifted and Israel is forced to reckon with its human rights abuses and breaches of international law. However, the German federal prosecutor also decided to hide behind the same Israeli smokescreen and ensure that Israeli regime impunity remains intact. Even if the Zionist regime's self-investigations were not a ruse, ECCHR and PCHR point out that in many of other cases involving Syria, Iraq, Gambia, and Sri Lanka, the German prosecutor did not require any legal steps to be taken domestically, let alone the exhaustion of all local remedies by victims or their relatives in their respective jurisdictions. This makes perfect sense, the group said, because international criminal justice does not require the exhaustion of domestic remedies before pursuing the case before foreign courts, especially considering that it is often very unrealistic for victims and their families to seize domestic courts with cases against the domestic armed forces or secret services. Ebrahim Tagrid and their children were killed after a desperate search for safety from the Zionist regime's bombs. Israeli warplanes had dropped leaflets on Beit Lahia, the northern Gaza town, where they lived near many members of their extended family, telling residents to leave. The couple took their kids and left, even though the rest of the family, including Ibrahim's mother, Fatima, and brother Saleh, urged them to stay. First, they wanted to stay with Tahrir's family, their boss in Shajaya, but that eastern Gaza city neighborhood would also be hit by devastating Israeli regime bombardments that flattened hundreds of homes and killed dozens of people. Now their boss family had to leave too. Ibrahim and Tahrir fled again, along with their children. Tahrir's sisters, Inas, Surah, and Aida, and her brother, Mahmoud. A friend offered them shelter at fifth floor office of an engineering company in Asalom Tower in central Gaza city of Ramal neighborhood, an area Israeli regime leaflets had claimed would be safe. But on the evening of July 21st, just as people in Gaza were breaking their Ramadan fast for the day, the Zionist regime bombed the tower. All 11 family members, including Ibrahim, Tahrir and the children, and Tahrir's four siblings, were martyred. The Zionist regime claimed the intended target was Shabana Duha, a commander of resistance movement who was also martyred in the attack. But whatever justification the fabricated regime of Israel offers, ECCHR believes the attack may constitute a war crime by the fake regime of Israel. The story of the Kilani family and how Ibrahim's surviving children, Ramses and Leila, and his brother Saleh continue to seek justice is told in the recent documentary, Not Just Your Picture, by Anne Pack and Dror Dayan. The filmmakers have expressed their outrage at the German prosecutor's decision not to investigate the Zionist regime's war crimes. Having closely followed the Kilani family's quest for justice in the years following the killing, it was clear to us that the path of German justice can only lead to a dead end, they said. Nevertheless, it is our duty to decry this blatant denial of justice, they added. Palestinians and their supporters face severe repression by German authorities. Ramses Kilani was himself detained by police last month, accused of defying a ban on public demonstrations in support of Palestine on Nakba Day.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.